Om Agyanatmanam Dasya Agyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshurim Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurudev Namah. This is Song 5 of Sharanagati, first part. Hear, O Lord, my story of sadness. I drank the deadly poison of worldliness, pretending it was nectar, and now the sun is setting on the horizon of my life. I spent my childhood in play, my youth in academic pursuit, and in me there rose no sense of right or wrong. In young manhood I set up a household and settled down to the spell of material enjoyment. Children and friends quickly multiplied. Soon old age arrived and all happiness departed. Subjected to disease, troubled and weak, all my senses are feeble. Now my body racked and exhausted, and my spirits downcast, in the absence of youthful pleasures. Devoid of even a particle of devotion, lacking any enlightenment, what help is there for me now? Only you, O Lord, friend of the fallen. I am certainly fallen, the lowest of men. Please, therefore, lift me to your lotus feet. Were you to judge me now, you would find no good qualities. Have mercy and judge me not. Cause me to drink the honey of your lotus feet, and thereby deliver this bhakti vinod. So we see a theme of here, this in this section of humility, a theme that's running through that of, what are the causes for humility? And we see generally the main cause of humility is attachment or attraction to this material world. That seems to be, that's what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is pointing out, is that we have a tendency to be, we're confident, we're proud, we're, feel well situated because of our material situation, our material endeavor. So when we understand, when either one's humiliated materially, that one understands that, one's youthfulness and one's youthful abilities and youthful pleasures are no longer there, and so in old age then we are not confident because the body doesn't function right, health is not good, mind doesn't work nicely, no one accepts us, in the sphere of sense gratification. We're an old person, we can give some advice or sit around, keep the rocking chair warm, or, something, some useful service like that. But otherwise, then we don't, it's not considered, does not have a great strong position in the world of enjoyment. So that's one thing. The other thing is that we see that we wasted life by engaging in all these things. So one creates humility based on that you wish you could be doing these things, but you can't, and therefore people, will think badly about you or say things about you. So therefore, it creates humility. But that humility is still with the desire for sense gratification. So that's the first step, in one sense, is that we at least recognize that and give up the desire, give up the endeavor for sense gratification when we don't have the facility for it. At least then that creates some humility. But more important than that is then what he's given is that next step of understanding is that we shouldn't have been doing this in the first place. We've given up the desire to want to enjoy in this world. So giving that up, then we find that this side then is working. So that, then we see these are, how to be humble. But it's here. Humble means that we're not so qualified. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is mentioning here is that if you check, if you judge, then then you will see that there's no good qualities like that. So the Lord, being friend of the fallen and very kind to the living entities, and if we take shelter of Him, then He will pick us up. But there has to be that humility, because one has to. We see in both that at least there's not in material endeavor, in humility. There's not material endeavor. Though in material humility, there is a desire for that, though one can't. But in the spiritual, then the desire has been given up. So that is actually what one is looking for. Because if one can completely give that up, Bhakti Vinod Thakur will talk about that later, then one actually becomes servant. And when we take on the servant mood, that's actually when devotional service is progressive. If we're not in the mood of servant, then devotional life actually isn't progressive. It can't be. One may become expert at devotional activities, but it doesn't mean that one has actually become expert at devotion. Does that make sense? Like that. So because without, if we're in the mood of that I'm the controller or enjoyer, then we will see that we can't get this to manifest. It just won't manifest. Because then, as the controller, then we're going to want to, you know, that I catch that service, get on top of it, become expert at it, conquer it. In other words, you're conquering the service rather than you're just humbly taking up the mood that I should engage my nature in Krishna's service. You know, this was the, we see this difference in, like in Arjuna in the Gita, then in the beginning he is confident of his prowess. So he's going to go out there and win this war. But then when he sees he's not going to get, he's not going to enjoy out of it, everything will be lost, then he's in this position. So he becomes very humble and just, why I should get involved in this. But it's still its material. So Krishna is saying, this is foolish, you have to take it to the spiritual platform. Where you see that this your humility is there, but that doesn't mean you do nothing. Material humility means you do nothing. Spiritual humility is you do something. Like that. So the idea is the spiritual humility should come before it's enforced upon us by material humility. At some point or another, we'll have to come to this stage. So the earlier we come, then we can do something. You know? But if we wait too long, then we're too old and too finished, and then what can you do? You know, then it's a very lamentable situation. So here Bhaktivinoda Thakur is trying to teach us to be, to avoid that kind of situation by taking it up at an earlier stage. So we see here is that this whole thing is childhood and play, youth and academic pursuit, and then in household life, then one just gets into enjoyment and expanding children, friends, all these things. So in there, arose no sense of right or wrong, because, how do you say? It means on the material platform, then that means what is good for us, what is good for our enjoyment or our personal thing, that's right, and what's against it is wrong. Then on the next platform is one can't tell the difference between material life and spiritual life. That's the other right and wrong. One can't tell. So therefore, one could take this both for the sinful person and for the pious person. The sinful person is they don't know what's right or wrong. They prefer any sinful activity if it's good for them. And the only reason they'd avoid a sinful activity is because it's not good for them. Right? Or the pious person, he knows what's right and wrong on the material platform, but he can't distinguish between what's materially, the material and the spiritual. So spiritual is right, material is wrong. Like that. So we see here is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is so expert in writing, you know, say Prabhupada, that he can present the same thing that applies to many different levels. So this song is, it's showing there's a progression through these songs, and at the same time as we see that the progression is on different levels. So that way a new person who is just taking up Krishna consciousness can appreciate it. And someone who's more advanced, they can appreciate it. Like that. So it's a very, very amazing. They're not ordinary songs, these songs. Srila Prabhupada, when devotees would sometimes want to write their own songs, Prabhupada would say, you know, the songs are already written. We don't have to write the songs. We just have to repeat what the others have already said. Also another interesting thing is that soon old age arrived, right? It's just childhood, he got his education, took up household life, everything started to happen, it was expanding, and then very soon old age arrived. like that. Means when we're younger, then it seems, oh, it's so far away. But if we think about it, whatever age we are, is that think back across our whole life up to this point. And how long did that take? Within the mind, it's a moment. You know, it's some moments. So then you figure out how old one is now, and then double that, you know, or triple that. You know, just take it until it gets to old age. So if one's 20, then it'll be, means if it was just a few moments, so then it'll be three times a few moments. You understand? If one's 30, then it's just the same amount of time, and you'll be old. And if you're already old, it's the same amount of time, and then we'll be gone.
Beginning.
Yeah. That's the point, is that it's not long. We're thinking, oh, that's so long. But it's not long. So that's the point he's pointing out. Very soon, old age arrived. So you just, it's not noticed because you're so busy, I'll arrange this, I'll arrange that, if I just get this together, just get that together, then it'll be perfect like this, that. And this way one's old. So youth is flickering. It seems that it's nice, it seems that it's there, but it's not. It doesn't last very long at all. It's a very, very flickering thing, this youth. Like that. We think it's, we take it that it'll last forever because that's the nature of the soul. The soul is eternally youthful. So therefore we relate to youthfulness. We don't relate to old age. Old age doesn't relate to us. Old age actually is the body. The soul, you know, always relates as youthful. But the problem is the soul is trying to enjoy through the body. So the body gets old and can't enjoy. So therefore the youthful pleasures that the body could enjoy that were more, how do you say, palatable to the soul, more close to the nature of happiness of the soul, though perverted, you know, mundane, then old age arrives, the body can't keep up, and then the soul is frustrated. The soul is, you know, it just can't get what it's looking for. Yeah, so here is that he's saying here, if you were to judge me now, you would find no good qualities. Have mercy and judge me not. Cause me to drink the honey of your lotus feet and thereby deliver this bhakti vinod. So it's like, one is so bad, if one surrenders, then there's the question of just leaving it. If not, then naturally judgment must be there. But if one surrenders, right, then there's the aspect of the Lord is kind, and if he doesn't judge us, then we can move on. Because devotional service is actually something else. We have a tendency to see devotional service in line with mundane religiosity. Mundane religiosity is you do an activity perfectly, you get a perfect result. You do it less than perfect, you get a not so perfect result. So the material activity itself is what qualifies you, and improper performance of it or something that's against the performance of it disqualifies you. But devotional service is on a different platform. Devotional service then means it's our desire to serve and please Krishna. That desire to serve and that endeavor to please Krishna through our endeavors, that's the devotional service. And then what we're doing is the medium that we're using for that. So even if it's not perfect, the devotion can be perfect. But at the same time, so that is the actual reality of devotional service. But we have to be careful in that. We have to be careful of two mistakes here. Is that one is, since it doesn't matter how well it's done, devotional service is perfect on its own. Therefore, I don't have to endeavor to do a wonderful job. I just do something and it's the devotion, Prabhu. Why you're so worried about all this, you know, smarter rules and regulations. No, it means what one's best is, it has to be the best. If one can't do so well, then you have to do your best at not doing so well. And if you can do very well, if you don't do very well, then it's not your best. So it has to be the best. So then one can get laziness from that. That's the sahajya. like that. The other is karma, is you thinking that I perform the activity, therefore that gets the bhakti. You know? I got up this morning, I went to Mangal Arati, therefore I must get bhakti. Because I did the rule, I followed the rule, I did the activity. I followed the rule. So therefore, since I followed the rule, I have to get the results. You know? And if I don't get the results, there's something wrong with this process. It's not a good religious process. No. Put the yellow in the back. No. Because then that's very high on the neck. See, garlands are made symmetrical. Right? So it'll go like that, or it'll go like that. So it'll go that way.
So it's probably simpler then. Actually, it was much more
lovely. Yeah, okay. See, because this, if you put it here, the neck goes there, right? This comes down. If you put that here, that goes on the neck. Okay? You understand the science? Someone has to notice these things. Okay, thank you. So, yeah, and the other is that the rule itself gets the result. So both of these are what's called niyamagraha. Is the one is I did it, I get the result. If I don't get the result, something's wrong with this religious process. And or the other is because this is beyond the mundane religious process, therefore such detail is not important. You know, such detail is not important. So then just leave it. So we see that those who are a little bit lazy or not so sophisticated have a tendency towards, or emotional, like that, lazy, what did I say? Lazy, unsophisticated, emotional, or, you know, just, how do you say, so-called practical, have a tendency to drop the rules. You know, and it doesn't matter. And those who have a tendency more sophisticated, more used to being religious or pious, like that, then sometimes less, more rational, less emotional, have a tendency to go the other way. So we see if there's too much mentalness or too much intellectualness, then it creates both these problems. So niyamagraha has to be. We have to be careful of this.
But you said something best. I don't understand. You cannot do your best.
No, we always have to do our best. Okay. It's not that the devotional process is we're utilizing the material activities and material facilities to serve Krishna, right? But that itself means the things themselves aren't the service. It's the act of engaging them in the service that's the service. It's the endeavor that's the service, right? So then, some then will say, because of that, then there's no need to worry about being too finicky about getting things right. Right? If one has the nature to get it right, one has to do it to the best of one's ability. Sometimes it may come out right, sometimes it may not come out right. But you've done your best to make it right. But if we're lazy, just saying it doesn't matter because it's the devotion, Prabhu, then that's not good. You know? In other words, you could say the same thing, it's the devotion, Prabhu, and use it to correct the situation or use it to make the problem. Someone who's trying to do nicely, and you say, don't worry about this. It's the endeavor. You know, it's the devotion. Then it's actually lowering the standard. You know? But the person who is so caught up in the details of the service that that's the perfection, and they completely forget that they're doing it for Krishna, then you can say, no, it's the devotion. You understand? So it's a very fine thing. That's why many times you see in the scriptures, the same point is made, but it's used in opposite ways. Because this is the world of duality. So the one thing cures both. Right? You take too much milk, it creates a disease. Same milk will cure the disease. So the same thing will work on both, though it's used in opposite in both.
Are you talking the same thing
here? Means the point is making the point that it's the devotion. Like in here, sometimes we're saying, someone just says it's the devotion, the sentimentalists. No, you have to practically do the service. At the same time, if someone else who's just totally absorbed in the service and completely forgotten why he's doing it, then you say it's the devotion. You remind them it's the devotion. You understand? So the same thing can be a proper application and can be a misuse. You know? Therefore, the person who's just sentimental and not properly applying themselves, you say, no, you have to do it properly. Right? So it corrects them, but the person who has more the smarter mentality, they'll say, no, you have to do it properly. And that's the misuse. Are you catching this or not? I've told the same things now from the two. It means you have the razor's edge, right? That's the devotional path. One side you have impersonalism, one side you have the sahaja, right? In other words, the karmi one side, the jnani the other side. Or the one who kicks out the rules and the one who overly follows the rules. Who feels the rule itself is what gets the perfection. And the other one says, since the rule doesn't get the perfection, we don't have to bother with the rules. Right? But the middle path, the actual path is we follow the rules, but we understand that that's the rule itself is not the perfection. Doing it for Krishna is the perfection. So we understand we do our best to do that rule. Right? So therefore one side says, it's the devotion that counts. Is being misused by the sahajiyas, but it's the cure for the mayavadis. Right? And the mayavadis say, you have to follow the rules. That is their misuse. That's the cause of the disease, but it cures the disease of the sahajiyas. You understand? So the whole point is you have to follow. So therefore, we can understand that since it creates the two opposites, if you put the two together, you get the middle. So you have to follow the rules, but it's the devotion that counts. That's the middle path. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Anything else on this? Yeah. Computer. Yeah. So you always have to be able to see, this is what, yeah, it means these are the things that to be able to discriminate these things. These are the things the intelligence is to be used for, to see the difference between one thing and another. What's devotion, what's not. Because sometimes one thing looks like devotion, but it's not. Another thing, sometimes something that doesn't look like devotion is. You know what I'm saying? You know, just like you have a little kid, you have this, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Saraswati. I don't remember, but I think it was Saraswati. She had this string. And the string was tied around a small, like 2-3 inch tall Jagannath. Just right around his waist, right? He has just a wooden Jagannath, no clothes. She has a string tied around his waist. And she has Jagannath on the ground, and the string in her hand, and Jagannath's dragging on the ground behind her. And she's walking along with the string. And you ask her, the parents, what's she doing, dragging Jagannath? She's at Rath Yatra. She's taking Jagannath on Rath Yatra. All right? So in her mind, there's a whole big cart, there's all these things, everything. So for in that mentality, it is Rath Yatra. So Prabhupada says, no, she sees it like that, it's not a problem. Right? Because of the mentality. But now, if if the adults think, oh, see, no, this is Prabhupada. Prabhupada said. So then they train their kid how to tie a string around it and drag Jagannath all over the house like that. That's nonsense. So one has to see how it applies according to the mentality. So the mentality is what's trying to be corrected. The problem in the world is not bad activity, it's bad mentality. Right? Bad activity only happens if there's bad mentality. The mentality is good, the activities are good. So we've come to this material world because we have a bad attitude. Right? Means in the material world everyone has an attitude problem. So that attitude problem is they think I'm the enjoyer. Right? So that has to be corrected and be brought to the proper thing that I am the servant. So the real thing in the material world is correcting the attitude. So all these things on regulations and different things and purifications and all that are actually just to purify the mentality. And because we identify with the body, therefore these things have to include the body. We identify with the mind. Right? They have to include the mind. We identify with the ego and with the intelligence, so those have to be included. But the real thing that you're trying to get to is the consciousness. Right? We engage the body with an idea of trying to get to the mind intelligence and gross body with the idea to get to the subtle body. And once we get to the subtle body and are able to engage that, then we're trying to get to the platform of the consciousness. Right? So therefore, since consciousness is our goal, that's why we become conscious of what's around us. We practice that, being conscious of things physically, conscious of things on the subtle platform, right? Like all this New Age stuff, the problem with it is becoming conscious of subtleties, but that's it. That's the goal. So it's useless. The whole thing is you become conscious of how the mind works, intelligence, the ego, and subtleties, so that you can go to the most subtle aspect of the consciousness, where it's, am I the enjoyer, or am I the servant? So that's what you're trying to get through. So anything that becomes a distraction, like the karmis, they engage the body, they're very conscious of their activities they're doing, that they're clean and do everything properly and everything's done with the right mantra, but that's the end of their goal, is just that, the heavenly planet. So it's so therefore useless. The impersonalists are conscious of the soul and the workings of the material energy and how the moving entity is bound here, but that's all they're looking for. So it's useless, it's just gyan. Right? Like that. The yogis are able to meditate and all that, but because they aren't actually conscious of themselves as servant. Right? Therefore, it's useless. But if it's done for Krishna, we work for Krishna, we understand the workings of the material nature and how to get out of this for Krishna, and we absorb ourselves in meditating upon Krishna, then it becomes devotional service, and that's the process. So one has to be very, very careful to be able to see, just, you know, how you say, stick to the line given by the acharyas. That's the thing. They point out what is, how much this way and that way, what's the balance. They give the balance, because the balance is to take you to a particular place. Right? To get you out of the material world, everybody's going to say the same thing. Right? It's the same thing. Once you get out of the spiritual world, then you have Vaikuntha, you have Dwarka, Mathura, Vrindavan, so many places you can go. Therefore, then they show which is the path to go there. Okay. Then continuing with the Jaiva Dharma. Chapter 2. So the Babaji is still speaking here on the nature of the soul. Okay. In the scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam, pure devotional service to Lord Vishnu is described. That devotional service is the eternal activity of the individual soul. Three different conceptions of the soul's nature are described in the material world. They are, one, the eternal nature, two, the temporary nature, and three, the nature that contradicts the eternal nature. The conception that rejects the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the eternal soul is the third of these, temporary nature, of the nature that contradicts the eternal nature. So that means that we're just the body. That's it. There's no God, and we're just the body. Life is made out of chemicals and all this and that. The conception that accepts the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and declares that one should employ temporary material means to win his mercy is the second of these. That's the temporary nature. And the conception that declares that by employing the activities of spiritual love, one should strive to obtain direct service to Lord Krishna is the first of these, the conception of the soul's eternal nature. Okay, so that's the definition. In other words, what we mentioned here is by material karma, you're going to get the Lord's mercy. Like that. So that's the temporary nature. Same time, that can be used in two ways. We'll see here. There's one that can be used in the way of one, like we mentioned before, one can perform karmic activities of you know, pious activities and figure that that alone will get to the Lord's mercy. The other is that they are used in a way to purify us of this material world for the purpose of getting number one. You know, employing the activities of spiritual love. So because we have the desire to attain to that spiritual love, we engage the material things of this world in his service. So because they're used in his service, they're not temporary anymore. So it actually then, that first one, the eternal nature, is then obtained by using the temporary nature in the Lord's service. So the temporary nature becomes empowered with the spiritual chitpotency of the, or the eternal nature. Like that. So then Babaji Maharaj continues. The conception of the soul's eternal nature may be described differently in different countries, among different peoples, and in different languages. But these descriptions all refer to the same eternal nature of the soul. Still, the Vaishnava religion followed in India is the original form, the prototype of all these conceptions of the soul's eternal nature. And the form of the Vaishnava religion that Lord Chaitanya, who is the son of Sakshi and Lord of our hearts, taught the world is the purest form of the Vaishnava religion, the form that the great souls filled with the bliss of pure spiritual love accept and follow. At this point, the saintly sannyasi folded his hands and said, "O Master, at every moment I see that what was taught by Lord Chaitanya, the son of Sachi, is the best form of pure Vaishnava religion. I also see that the theory of impersonal monism taught by Shankaracharya is very wretched and horrible." Still a thought has risen in my mind, a thought I will not accept, unless it is first placed before your feet. It is this: is the state of deep ecstatic spiritual love revealed by Lord Chaitanya really different from the state of merging into the impersonal supreme? When he heard the name Shankaracharya, the Paramahamsa Babaji at once offered dandavat obeisances. Now he spoke the following words: "O noble-hearted friend, one should always think Shankaracharya is Lord Shiva himself. Shankaracharya is actually the spiritual master of all the Vaishnavas. That is why Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu honors him with the title Acharya. Shankaracharya is a perfect Vaishnava. When Shankaracharya appeared in Bharatvarsha, there was a great need for a guna avatar of the Lord. The voidist philosophy of Buddha had already practically destroyed the teachings of the Vedas and the duties of Varnashram Dharma. Voidist Buddhism even denied the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although it did hint at the existence of the individual soul. Buddhism denied the soul's true eternal nature. At that time, the Brahmanas had practically become Buddhists and practically abandoned the religion of the Vedas. It's interesting that Sahajya is actually Vaishnavism mixed with Buddhism. This path of Sahaj, the Sahaj, is actually coming from Buddhism. Like that, because they have in their process something, a very simple, easy method. So that's what's been mixed with the Sahajya. So that's the name comes like that.
Impersonalism?
No, impersonalism. Voidism. Buddhism. Not impersonalism. Voidism. Technically how it works, I don't know. But someone was pointing that out. That it's mixed with... There's some aspect of Buddhism in there. Because there's some path within the Buddhist path called Sahaj.
Like that. Difficult.
Yeah, I don't can't say the details. Like that. At that time, extraordinarily powerful Lord Shiva descended as Shankaracharya to this world, re-established the authority of the Vedas, and transformed Voidist Buddhism into the philosophy of Vedic impersonalism. For succeeding in this extraordinary work, the world will be long indebted to Shankaracharya. Every work in this world may be considered in two ways. Some work is useful in the context of a certain period of time, and other work is useful for all time. Shankaracharya performed work that was very important for that particular period in history. From his efforts, many good results came. Sri Ramanujacharya and Sri Madhvacharya built the palace of pure Vaishnava religion on the walls and foundation created by Sri Shankaracharya. Therefore, Shankaracharya is a great friend of the Vaishnava religion. He is one of its founding teachers. The benefit created by Shankaracharya's teachings is now enjoyed without any effort on their part by the Vaishnavas. In other words, means that because they were misusing the Vedic religion for their own purposes, therefore Buddhism came, the Lord brought Buddhism just so that it would take people away from the Vedas, so they wouldn't misuse them. But then in that point, then the Lord himself was taken out of the whole picture, and the whole Vedic processes were basically, practically lost. So then Shankaracharya came, and he re-established the whole Vedic culture, and Vedic culture is for the purpose of creating Vaishnavas. That's what it's for. It's for correcting or reforming the living entity that's fallen into this material world. So by that process, then one can be reformed to understand that one is a servant of the Lord. And he, you know, again brought in that things aren't void, that there's actually Brahman. So he brought it from voidism into the first stage of God realization of Brahman, understanding Brahman. Then, with that, then because it was accepted, the Vedic culture and all these different aspects of it, then Ramanuja and Madhva, then they could come and then establish pure Vaishnava teaching. Because then the culture is already there, and the basic processes are there. Just now, they took it from Brahman to Bhagavan realization. So then that's there. So he's making the point is that it was very necessary for Shankaracharya to do that service at that time. Now, once the Vaishnavacharyas come, then that work itself is not practiced. But what the principle is that it's established of re-establishing the Vedic culture, then that's very good. You're bringing everything back to a Vedic perspective rather than a non-Vedic.
So everything that Shankaracharya taught Vedic, because you also have things like Panchopasana and all that. Is that Vedic?
Yeah, those are all Vedic.
Or is it speculation? Because everything is one. Right?
It's Vedic. It's to see you have three levels of God realization. Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And so then when you see everything is Brahman, then that means you understand the transcendental nature of everything and how everything has come from Brahman. Everything is Brahman. Everything's a transformation of Brahman. But the problem is they're not able to understand what is the nature of that, the full nature of Brahman. They only understand the eternal aspect. But they don't understand that Brahman also has two other aspects. That besides eternality, then there's knowledge and bliss. So that they don't understand. Right? So what he's given is useful in that it's gotten rid of voidism and brought it back to the Vedic path. Right? But in the Vedic path, the Brahmananda is not actually the religion of the soul. Right? It's a concept of this world. The soul means Sat Chit Ananda. So if you only take Sat, you can't say that it actually addresses the need of the soul. Right? And the yogis, they take Sat and Chit. So therefore that also is still a mundane concept. That's it. They're parts of God realization. They exist in the Supreme Lord. But to say that that is the complete whole, the complete truth, that's a material concept. That's a mundane concept. The spiritual concept is understanding that it is more. Right? That it's Bhagavan. He's the source of Paramatma. He is the source of the Brahman. So in other words, he is Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Right? So therefore, then it's that whole thing works like that. Right? So that is the. Does that make sense? So what he's done is good, but it was good for that time. But since then the next has come. Right? In other words, you have this nice palace of pure Vaishnavism established by Ramanuja and Madhva. That doesn't mean that then you go and dig into the ground to go look at the foundation. You appreciate what's there. The foundation is to make the building. Right? So now the building's there, then we appreciate that. Right? So that's why he's given it. That's why he makes the point. It was good for that time. Like that. It was good for that time. Otherwise, the tendency will be to think, oh, if it was good, if Shankaracharya is good, then we can read his books and his philosophy. No. His philosophy was for getting rid of Buddhism. If you want to know how to destroy Buddhism, then that's impersonalism. But then that has to be taken out, because it has to go to the next stage. So impersonalism, it has to go to personalism. That's the next stage. The Vedic culture stays in place, but it goes to there. So Panchapasana means worship of these five deities, but they're also the levels of consciousness. So according to consciousness, you will worship one of these five.
Which five deities are
they? They're Durga, Shiva, Ganesh, Surya, and Vishnu. So worship of Durga is for those people who are absorbed in this material world. It means immaterial enjoyment facilities, stuff, you know. Like, they want goods. Right? You know, like that. So, that is that level. So that's the Anamoy platform. Like that. Then the next platform, Pranamoy, is then these two, is Ganesh and Surya. So the difference between them is Surya means you worship life. Like that, you know, nature. You know, you go out into the forest and the nature and its beauty and life, you know, the human race, just not even human race, just life, and you appreciate life and that kind of thing, energy, that kind of thing. Because sun is general, it's energy. So like that. More specific than that is worship of the Ganapati, the Ganapatis. So, Gana, some group. So then you worship humans, you worship the animals, you worship, you know, some form of life, you know. Like that's important, you know. My mother and my father, or you know, something like that. Then it gets specific like that. Then Shiva then is the impersonal. So we understand the soul is there. And, you know, basically we're not the body and this and that. That's why Shankaracharya then taught the impersonalism. Because right? that's his area that he deals with. You know, he lives in the Brahman, like that, with all his associates and everything, but that's where his residence is.
Brahman.
Yeah. It's all in Brahman.
But it said that there's no activity in Brahman.
There's no activity for those who have given up their material bodies and not accepted spiritual bodies and live in Brahman. But those who live with Lord Shiva, then they're active in Brahman. That's just where they live. Just like the people in the sun planet, they're active there.
So there are residents in the Brahman who are active.
It's just like this. You're moving in the sunlight,
okay.
Right? But the sunlight itself, what's it doing? Yeah, so the sunlight is simply a reflection of Brahman. So Krishna's effulgence is the Brahman. So those who are merged in the Brahman are doing nothing. But those who are moving through Brahman, they're doing something. Otherwise, where do the residents of Vaikuntha, when they come to the material world, they're going through the Brahman. It's just a big space in between the spiritual realm and the material realm. And it's full of effulgence that's coming from Krishna's aura.
Suppose they have some residence in it. They'll always be moved.
No, they can have residence there. How do you have residence here?
Okay.
So the point is that's not the point. You know? I mean, that's a side point, whatever. Point is that he deals with these things, understanding we're not the body. He deals with the ego. You know, like that. So giving up the ego. But the thing is giving up ego, then you're supposed to attain what is the original ego. So that's the thing. So he only gave half. That's what he did. Shankaracharya means Buddhism, there's no proper understanding of ego at all. You don't understand the ego of the soul, you don't understand the ego of the Lord, nothing. There is no Lord, and the soul is also basically, there's a hint at it, but basically there also is no soul.
There's no soul, basically.
Yeah, basically there's no soul. So it means there is you become nothing.
Mm-hmm.
While the impersonal instance, you go into the Brahman. Right? So he's given the identity that we are soul. And soul exists, and there is Brahman, so there is a Supreme. So he set the foundation. But the other half of this is, I am soul, so what is my ego as soul? So he's removed the material ego, but he hasn't, as Shankaracharya, established the real ego. You understand? So that then Madhva and Ramanuja do, that we're servants of the Lord. Like that. So it's a progression from Buddhism to Shankara's. It's a progression. So the principles of soul, supreme, like that, that we're not part of this material world, that has been established. But actually understanding the Lord and the whole thing, that is not understood. Because you're only looking at it from the angle of Sat. Right? Like that.
Then after Lord Shiva, you have Vishnu. Then
you have Ramanuja, Acharya, and Madhvacharya.
In terms of the different Annamaya, Jitis.
Oh, like that. And then Vishnu in the mode of goodness. They see Vishnu is in the mode of goodness. Like
that.
Not really. Because they all stay in the material world. I don't think it really is an Annamaya. You know, it may be that, but it also may be we see that Vishnu establishes, you know, the proper religious principles and all that. So it could be seen from that angle, or it could be seen from the lower end of the impersonal side of Anandamaya. There is an aspect, the Brahmavadis are also in Anandamaya. like that.
So we move again.
I don't. Generally, you see, it's more kind of they use it. They could use it both for taking the impersonal to the next step of that Brahmananda. But at the same time, as it also can be for establishing proper performances of duty in this world, because the mode of goodness means, you know, proper religious principles being performed and these kind of things like that.
Isn't what Srila Prabhupada called the philosophized Vishnu?
Yeah. Is Vishnu the mode of goodness?
See, he calls him the philosophized
Vishnu. Does it give an explanation of the meaning of philosophized Vishnu?
I have to find the quote.
Yeah.
But one point is, he writes in the philosophized Vishnu.
Yeah. They just philosophize about him, but they don't serve him. That's the point. There's no service. So that's why it can't actually get beyond, it wouldn't get beyond the impersonal state. Like that.
Because I remember one time I was in Calcutta, walking during Durga Puja with my Guru Maharaj, and there was those five deities on one altar in one street. And I was about to pay my obeisances, and Guru Maharaj told me not to need, because that Vishnu is not our Vishnu. So he said they don't consider him as God. So you
come in with me to do Satyanarayan Puja. So Satyanarayan Puja basically is just pious activities to get elevation to heavenly planets. So basically they worship him for that purpose. So that way then you get these four levels of Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha through these.
You said Durga corresponds to Annamaya, and then Shiva and, Surya and
Ganesh.
Ganesh correspond to?
Pranamaya.
Manomaya?
Basically, Vishnu. Same times we see Shiva, worship Shaivites, they generally follow, depends upon which form of Shiva they follow, worship. But they follow very nicely the religious principles. Unless they're going completely to the left side, then they don't follow anything.
The beginning is Shiva.
Yeah, because that's the knowledge of the soul. And it's, otherwise it's not. The generally those who are worshipping Vishnu, philosophize Vishnu, aren't dealing on the platform of the soul. They're mainly interested in pious results, fruitive results.
So that's also beginning.
It's Manamaya.
The main problem is that they don't take spirit and matter as the base. Is that the main problem? Like they see things in terms of good and bad, as you were saying earlier, rather than seeing things in terms of spirit and matter.
Yeah, it's all mundane. Like that. The impersonalists, then they see the difference between spiritual and material. But they don't really properly see what's material. They understand with spirit, but they don't actually, it's not full knowledge. Because until you know what is the actual nature of the soul, the material world, and God, then that's full knowledge. So they have partial that. They understand that there is soul and he's Brahman. They understand there's the Lord and that's just Brahman. And the material world is just an illusion. It's either all Brahman and all these forms are just illusion. So actually, in their ideas, it doesn't exist. It's just Brahman. So it's not complete, because it can't. It can't for them exist because they don't have a complete form of the Lord. So when the Lord is a person and he has all his activities, then we understand the material world is real, but our giving value to it, that is not real. Means this wall exists, but the material value we put on the wall, that's illusion. You know, just like a piece of gold exists, but that we say it's very valuable, that's illusion. Right? Because on the Brahman platform, pebble and gold, they're both just earth, transformations of earth. They're all, and earth is, it's all, material energy is one of Krishna's energy, therefore it's Brahman. So then they don't differentiate between the value of them. You know, it doesn't mean that they run through trees. No, they go around the tree. You know, it's just that, but the tree itself is not a great value. They won't be running along, and as they're running along, then suddenly they'll stop and go, wow, that's a 1933 Bugatti. You know, like this. They're not going to do that. It's not going to have value to them. Just like Sukadeva is running, and then there's the young girl is taking bath. They're not of value to him. They're souls, and they're Brahman, just like the trees and the dirt and all this. So they're not a specific value for enjoying. Like that. If they came and asked him a question, even they were, he's standing there with no clothes and they're standing there with no clothes, he would just be seeing this pure spirit soul. Because the bodies are just material energy. There's nothing for him as soul to enjoy. Right? Because soul can only enjoy transcendental.
So that's why we have to give up eventually transcend goodness, because it's just another aspect of the duality.
Yeah, but it when one gets to the Brahman platform, then that's when it's given up. That's otherwise one acts within it. Even on that platform, generally, for example, it's acted within.
And the consciousness has
yeah.
Been.
Yeah, it's very different. But that's why you see is the preacher is the Madhyama, because the Uttama doesn't preach. Because it's all, everything's Brahman, and all everybody's all spirit soul, and everybody's servant of Krishna. So what's there to preach about? You know, who's there to preach to? Everybody's the eternal spirit soul. So there's no one to preach to. So that's why they have to come down to the Madhyama platform to preach. And they have to discriminate between who is servant of the Lord and who's not. Who's inimical, who's not. You know, so to see the Lord who's favorably disposed, who's innocent, and who's inimical. Like that. So in this way then they distinguish. Otherwise the Uttama doesn't distinguish. Yes?
If these Muslims do not believe in the form of the Lord, then how come they worship deities?
It's for them, it's a means to an end. It's just like you want to get up to the next floor, so you use the stairs. But once you get to the next floor, you don't need the stairs anymore.
But those who are worshipping Vishnu, don't they get devotional benefit because they're worshipping Vishnu for their material needs?
If they're worshipping for material needs, yes. If they're worshipping for impersonal needs, no. But the point is that until one comes in contact with the pure devotees, then you don't actually know what devotion is. So by worshipping Vishnu without any, you know, offense, you consider him the Supreme Lord. And since he's the boss, you're going to him. Then one may come in contact with the devotees. But the path, it's a very slow path, and it's not sure. Right? It means you're going to worship Vishnu. How are you going to worship Vishnu?
You just probably ask for their needs.
Yeah, that's there, but I'm saying they're going to have to use some Vedic method. Right? So generally you'll see is they would do yajnas. So then at a yajna, then there has to be so many priests. And the yajnas are in the morning and evening. So that means during the day, there's no ritual going on. So that time of the day is meant for those Brahmins to sit together and whoever else is interested and discuss philosophy. That's what the yajna is meant for. Like you see the sages of Naimisharanya, they were gathered for a 1,000-year sacrifice. But we don't hear about the sacrifice, really. We hear about what they discussed in the day. So they would do their yajna in the morning, And then all day they would sit and discuss, you know, whatever they're discussing, Mahabharata or Puranas or all these things. Then, in the evening, then they would do the evening part of the yajna. Right? So that's what it's for. That's the path of karma. So then you're technically supposed to be worshipping Vishnu. But unfortunately, they may miss that and worship demigods instead. So when the Brahmins come, if any of them are Vaishnav, then he may hear Vaishnav philosophy. Otherwise, then the tendency is just to hear about karma. You had Maharaj Prachina Barhishat performed so many yagyas and so many qualified Brahmins. And they never told him about Vishnu. They didn't know. They were Karmakandi Brahmins. That's all they knew. You know, so they don't talk. They don't talk about it.
So worship Vishnu for material benefits, can they be classified as impersonalists?
No. It depends upon who they are. It depends upon who they're, how they're seeing Vishnu. You understand? If they see him as the Supreme Lord, and we're his servant, and we have these material desires, so you go to him for them, then they're devotees, but they're not so advanced devotees, like the demigods. Mm-hmm. Yes. But if they're approaching Vishnu to worship because it's just a method, right? It's just a method of something to focus the mind and all these things and develop these good qualities by which one can free oneself from material entanglement. And so then you become Vishnu, then that's not very useful. Because those people, they're worshipping Vishnu, and they say they're worshipping Vishnu, but they'll also say they are Vishnu, so they're worshipping themselves. You understand? Yeah?
They learn to give up their material ego, but they do not know their true ego. Is that right?
Yeah, they give up the mundane ego, but they don't give up. They don't accept the true because they don't accept that they're a servant of God.
But you think that I am God is the biggest ego. So how are they giving up the ego?
They're giving up the idea that I am this body. That's the mundane ego. Right, from Brahma down to the ant, then they're thinking, I am this, I am Brahma, I am an ant. I'm a Brahmin, I'm a Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, I'm a man, woman, I'm an animal, I'm a human. That they've given up. So they have no ego of this material world that fits within the 8,400,000 species. That they've given up. But they haven't, because they haven't given up the idea that I'm the enjoyer, I'm the controller. Therefore, they haven't really, that's why we can't really call it spiritual.
Causalist.
Yeah, yeah. So they're maintaining the identity of polluted consciousness, like that. That they're keeping. You understand? So they just see themselves as sat, not sat. Because if they accept their chit and ananda, then you know they take chit. They'll take chit to be the knowledge of, you know, the impersonal path, and that I am Brahman, and ananda meaning the happiness from being there. But that's not things. Because chit also means activity. So there is no activity in the Brahman. So therefore, it can't be chit. And ananda means relationship. So technically, if they look at it, then Brahmananda doesn't, in what they describe, doesn't actually exist. It's Brahmananda because it's when we're here, it's I will be happy going there. So there's me and there. That will give me happiness because there's a relationship there. Right? There's two. Or when one gets into the Brahman, then one is happy, because I am out of the material world, because there's me in the material world. You understand? So, but they're not taking it to that point. They don't understand that. Therefore, because this relationship, that's what creates happiness. This other, this idea of, what is that? It's nothing. How will there be happiness? Happiness here is because of attaining something. What you've attained, so there's you and what is attained. So it's not well thought out. You know, just the people are fried, so therefore they don't think too far. You don't think beyond what your happiness is. You don't, because then that may reduce your happiness or may be a problem for your happiness. Does that make sense? Like that. So they don't want to think beyond. Just like the non-Vedic materialists don't want to think about death. You know, because it's an obstacle for their happiness. You know? So the same way as for the impersonalists, they think past this, then they got a problem. Because right now, as this much, it makes them happy with that idea, they're inspired. And then if you discuss that, then it goes against their idea of happiness. Therefore, that's the problem. Their mind has accepted it. That's the thing, mind's not logical. You know, though they're very logical, but the mind has stopped at a certain point, and then therefore the logic is gone at that point. And it's just sentiment. That I am Brahman. But they still want to enjoy Brahman, Brahmananda. So that's the enjoying mood. And then the controller is, I'm God. I'm God and I'm enjoying. Okay?
Since Brahman is fully spiritual, since this consciousness is not fully spiritual, how could they be in Brahman? Since they have that...
Brahman is, but why?
But they have that...
Okay, can you go into a pond of water?
Okay.
Are you water? Done? You understand? So you can go into it. Just like the other devotees, they walk through it. So you can be in it, though you're not the same thing.
Prabhupada gives the analogy of a green bird and a green tree.
Yeah. Funny, they also use that. But we use a green bird and a green tree to mean that the soul and the bird are still there. I mean, the bird and the tree are still there. But it looks like they've merged. They haven't merged. So the soul goes there to Brahman. It hasn't become Brahman separate from. It's still an individual spirit soul. Because otherwise, how does it fall out? The idea is it merges. But it doesn't. It still remains separate. So with that, they use it to say the green bird is kind of the green tree, so therefore it's all green. That's the thing. But we say a green bird is kind of a green tree means there's still a tree and there's still a bird. Have you ever seen that? A parrot going to the green tree, you can't see them at all. They just go in and they just disappear.
My question was, how is it permitted that that's the realm of pure consciousness, isn't it? So with impure consciousness, how can you get into that realm?
It's just sad. It's just the effulgence of the Lord. That's the big deal. They can merge into his body, why they can't merge into the Brahman? It's not a special place, it's not some special thing. Yeah, like Shishupal, he merged into the body. Everything comes from Krishna, so one can go back inside Krishna's body.
Then would it be come out also?
They will come out. They can't stay in there forever.
Anyway, they go inside every creation, after every creation, relation, they go inside.
That's a, anyway, all the living entities go and merge into the body of Vishnu at annihilation. So everybody enjoys the you know, either the yogic merging or the how do I say, the Buddhist, you know, Sayuja. I mean, what's it?
Oh, Nirvana.
Then they come out into the pradhan. So when the living entities come with time, the ego, then it becomes surcharged. So it becomes mahat tattva. So that's the impersonal state. That's that Vasudeva sattva. But not Vasudeva sattva. It's the state of Vasudeva. So all living entities then experience the impersonal idea, because they're just in Brahman, because the material energy is Brahman, and they're in that Brahman. But they're there and they're awake now. It means in the body of the Lord they're asleep, but in the Brahman they're awake, they're conscious. They're conscious that they want to enjoy. That's why it says it's agitated. Then it manifests, and then after Brahma's creation, then we see then there's karma. So karma, jnana, and yoga, these three are experienced every time Lord Mahavishnu breathes in and out. So therefore these are concepts of this world, they're not concepts of the spiritual world. Spiritual world is just pure devotion.
That's obvious from my philosophy, because I don't even discuss the Mahatma.
Yeah.
In terms of the actual, you know, the process and what they think, they don't go beyond that. They can't explain beyond that.
No, they don't. Because if you explain, if there's something beyond that, then their theory as it stands can't stand, and they would have to become Vaishnavas. That's the thing, because beyond they get to Vaikuntha and like that. Or even, yeah, so they don't understand it so well.
Imagine
that
the Lord's body is like,
void, is it? That's one aspect. It means that they're asleep. But from what I understand is the voids go down into the Garbhodak mud.
Like a mud bath.
Huh?
Mud bath.
Mud bath, yeah, because it's dark. See, they like it to be dark. Impersonalists want it to be light. You know, and voids want it to be dark. No, I'm saying the experience of merging with the Lord's body is every living entity who's in the material world experiences at the end of creation. Every living entity experiences the platform of being merged in Brahman when they are again brought out. And all the living entities then experience the realm of karma, of fruitive activities. So I'm saying is karma, jnana, and yoga, these things, these are constantly being experienced by the living entity. That's why they can think in these three. Right? You say any of these three, it makes sense. Just like this. But if you say devotional service, that doesn't make sense in this material world, because it's something totally different than anything that's been done. We're doing activities, but not for us. Right? We're on the Brahman platform, but we're still engaged in activities. Right? We're merged with the Lord, but not physically, only in the realm of purpose. So it's very different than anything we've experienced. But that's why it takes time to give up these three. Does that make sense? That's so conditioning is basically just giving up those three and accepting that I'm servant of God, that's all. So long we thought I'm God, I'm the enjoyer. So then all that's happening is that we're accepting I'm not the enjoyer, I'm not the controller, I am servant of Krishna. And if that's accepted, that means completely, so that we don't see ourselves as controller and enjoyer at any point, then one is freed from the material contamination. And then one then takes up devotional service.
So one is immediately situated on the Uttam platform.
The bottom line is you've got a choice of mental platform or being centered.
Say again?
The bottom line is we have a choice between being on the mental platform and being on the platform of being centered.
Yeah, that's it. That's all. So, but since we're so used to this, being in this whole material, you know, mentality, this whole material idea that I'm going to get something here, then that just takes a long time. It's like waking up from a dream. If it's a really heavy dream, it takes a long time to kind of get all those visions to go away. So that's the thing. You know, it's just like someone's had a bad dream and they're always seeing the things or any sound that gets them. So in this material world, even though it's spiritual, then we see so many things and we think, oh, we'll all enjoy this or all control that or all, you know, it's the same thing. And then we have to either by the Lord reminding us through creating difficult situations so we find out we're not the controller and enjoyer, or by association with devotees where they, you know, inform us or give good example where we give that up, or by our own, you know, study and contemplation where we are able to observe the situation, we see it came up and then we see what was this and then we analyze that and then are able to understand that it's another area in which we're trying to control and enjoy, and then, you know, then therefore then make that step to want to give that up. That makes sense.
The Bhagavatam, there is this prayer that the child makes in the womb of the mother. He's praying to Vishnu saying that I don't want to forget you or anything like that. So that's like the nearest past. So how come that's also an experience of remembering the Lord? That's also an experience of devotional service. So how come we don't, like you said, we don't have experience of devotional service? In the womb, the child is praying to the Lord.
That is also not every child. You know, that's not every child. That's only those who are quite elevated, from what I understand. You know, pious persons, that's their, gross materialists, they don't know what's going on. You know, but the problem is that as soon as we take birth, then immediately, then we're the center of attention. Right? And so then we kind of get to like that. You know? So then like that we become habituated. We become reconditioned into the material consciousness. You know, and also we see there it's more out of anxiety. So it's not a highly elevated platform. Is that the soul is suffering, therefore he's calling to the Lord. He's not asking for wealth or other things. He's suffering, so therefore there's artha, something he's approaching. Yeah. Does that make sense? Anything else on this? Okay. Individual souls, continuing with the reading, individual souls still in the grip of material bondage urgently need to understand their relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The individual soul is different from and superior to the gross and subtle material bodies in the material universes. The Vaishnavas and Shankaracharya agree on this point. They do not disagree on the spiritual nature of the individual soul. So here is that he's making this point, is that the material, the living entities, the conditioned living entities, need to understand their relationship with the Supreme Lord. So that's the point being made. Now he's taking it step by step. First, that the living entity is different and superior to the material energy. Like that. They're not the gross body, they're not the subtle body, but they're spirit soul. That Shankaracharya and the Vaishnavas completely agree on. That's the same point. Like that. So up to this point, there's no disagreement on the nature of the individual soul. Like with the Buddhists, there is. They say there is no soul. You know, some of the others, the Vaisheshikas, will also say there's no soul. Like that. And they'll say superior and not meant to enjoy this material world. While the karma mimamsas will say he's meant to enjoy this world. They'll say there is an eternal soul, but he's meant to enjoy this world. So therefore, all these other five philosophies, other than Shankara, then they really don't know what's going on at all. Shankara understands the nature of the soul, and that he's not part of the material world. So that much is agreed upon. Liberation is defined as becoming free from the material world. Both agree on this also. Up to the stage of liberation, Shankaracharya and the Vaishnavas agree on many points. So that liberation is defined as getting out of the material world, that we'll also agree on. We will also say that's liberation, we'll call that perfection. We'll say these things. But there's the supreme liberation, supreme perfection. This is where there's some difference. So So up to this. And then some of the technicalities on how they become liberated. You know, by giving up attachments to the material world, austerity, many of these things. We all, Vaishnavas and Shankaracharya agree. Right? Then the next point. By worshipping Lord Hari, one purifies his heart and obtains liberation. Shankaracharya teaches this also. So that worship of Hari is how you're going to get out of this material world. They also say the same. Shankaracharya also teaches this. Now comes the difference. However, about the state of existence that is superior to impersonal liberation, Shankaracharya is silent. Shankaracharya knew well that if the individual soul employed the worship of Hari as the way to proceed on the path of liberation, the soul would begin to taste the pleasures of devotional service and would eventually become a pure devotee of Lord Hari. It is for this reason that Shankaracharya, after showing the true path, did not reveal anything more about the secrets of Vaishnava religion. They who carefully study all his commentaries can see that this was Shankaracharya's hidden intention. It is only they who waste time merely circle the outskirts of Shankaracharya's teachings. Some editing problem here. It is only they who waste their time merely circling the outskirts of Shankaracharya's teachings who stay far away from the Vaishnava religion. Like that. So Shankaracharya was pointing that you worship Vishnu, then you'll get. So then by doing that, then they would get a taste out of that. But the problem is they say, I am Vishnu. But they're supposed to say, I am Brahman. Right? Otherwise, why I am Vishnu? I am also the dog, or I am also the wall. It's all Brahman. Why Vishnu? Why do they take that status? You know, they say, well, you know, Krishna is dancing with so many gopis, so I am Vishnu, I can also dance. Yeah, but I mean, the pig is also Brahman, and he's eating garbage, so then you can also eat garbage. No, why do they pick this? That he didn't teach. He taught them to worship and to be interested in Brahmananda. But they've changed it from Brahmananda into Mayavad. So they speak against this one. We can see here is he took it up to liberation and then he was quiet. He was silent. So he doesn't say anything bad about the Supreme Lord. He doesn't say that we are Vishnu. He just says that we are Brahman. They take it to that point. They speculated this. That's why he's saying here, Shankaracharya's his own commentaries like that don't say these things. So you can see as they bring it to a point and stomp, but they hint at the other. But the difficulty is then that his followers, they've created this whole mess. They've actually created.
But it says that if you worship, something like it says here that if you worship Vishnu as Brahman, then eventually they'll get the taste and take up devotional service. Something like that?
Yeah, it says here. However, about the state of existence that is superior to impersonal liberation, Shankaracharya is silent. Shankaracharya knew well that if the individual soul employed the worship of Lord Hari as the way to proceed on the path of liberation, the soul would begin to taste the pleasures of devotional service and would eventually become a pure devotee of Lord Hari. It is for this reason that Shankaracharya, after showing the true path, did not reveal anything more about the secrets of Vaishnava religion. So he showed the true path up to liberation and then just stopped speaking. So those who are his followers, then they think that that's it. But that's all just all the farther he taught. From there, the rest of the teaching was going to be given by Ramanuja Mahatma. Like that. It means that before that, to even start, means if you're gross, sinful, violent nonsense, then you're not going to get anywhere. So Buddhism at least will make you non-violent. Right? And the ultimate goal of non-violence is that you give up violence to the soul, which is understanding that I am servant of Krishna. Right? To deny that the soul is servant of Krishna and servant of the Lord, that's violence. Right? To say the soul is God, that's violence to oneself. Right? Because violence means what is not for the benefit of another living entity. You know, what would be a disturbance for the proper performance of the Dharma of another living entity. You understand? So the Dasha Dharma of the soul is to serve God. So to deny that, then it's violence. That's why they say the killer of the soul. Right? The impersonalists are called the killer of the soul. So basically everybody in the material world is. But when it gets too gross, then it just becomes completely useless. So therefore they have to turn them around. So then it's progressive from complete sinful activity to Buddhism. Because at least it makes them peaceful and makes them non-violent. You know, and develops another, host of other qualities. If it's performed as Lord Buddha taught it, how it's being taught presently, that may or may not represent the original, just as how it's the Shankarites that are, they're not properly following Shankaracharya either. So that's the next step. Take them into something that's subtler and higher. Then the next step is that they understand that the soul and that this material world is, they have to leave through, the Vedic processes. And of the Vedic processes, worship of Vishnu is the best. Like that. But he doesn't say we are Vishnu. He just says we're Brahman. They take it as that, you're Brahman, I'm Brahman, we're all Brahman. Yes, we're all that, but that doesn't say that that means we're the same. It's like I say, you're a man, I'm a man, we're all men. Right? Yeah, so does that mean that this is a room full of one person? No, there's so many persons here. You understand? But they take it to mean that it's merged. So therefore, Vishnu is Brahman, I'm Brahman, then I'm Vishnu. But that's not what Shankara taught. He simply taught the path of liberation. And that the best way to do that is through worship of Vishnu. Like that. But they've misconstrued into this. Does that make sense?
When you said some time ago that Ramanuja, after the Shankaracharya, when he was preaching philosophically, he talked about systematic management of Chiranjit and Ishwara. How did Shankaracharya develop that further, that framework, or did he use the same?
No, basically that's pretty standard. It's a Vedic standard, chitta, chitta, and ishwara.
So, Bhagavanatha calls it first one to start expanding it?
Oh, no, they would all expand. They would expand it in the way of giving detail within what's chit, what's achit, what is ishwara. But extending more points than that, then I don't think they are, other than,
so
chitta, chitta, ishwar, then there's devotional service, and then there's the goal of developing love for God. So, in other words, chitta, chitta, ishwar is just the breakdown, is the technical breakdown of sambandha, like that.
And so, wasn't it Because
I think they all work on the principle. But to have it just so... to bring out this sambandha vidaya prayojana so clearly, that's something that Lord Chaitanya has brought out. Because the Vedic literature describes so many things from so many angles. Just like in Brahma Samhita, I forget how many elements it says there are. I think it says 9, right? Whole material world is a verse. It mentions the whole material world is made of 9 elements. So it's just that they pack different ones into each other. Like that. And so it's just like, you know, it's just like you think of the sense and the sense object, we don't think of the thing in between, the tanmatra, like that. So they can be folded back. So these 15 you can fold into 5. And 5 you can actually fold into 1. And that you can fold into the mind. So technically you say the mind, you mean the senses, the sense objects. You know, and the tanmatras, and you mean the working senses. So you can fold 20 items into one, or 21 items into one. Like this, so depending upon what angle you're looking at it, they will open or close all these different things. So that then gives so many definitions within the Vedic literatures that people become confused. So Lord Chaitanya came and established what it is. Otherwise some say, like there's 9 elements, I think there's description up into 30-something elements. So then Lord Chaitanya said there's 24.
So then we're looking at CC.
Yeah. It means the conclusions of the whole Vedic literature then is given by Lord Chaitanya. So that with that, then that you can understand the whole Vedic literature. With, from that angle, then you can really understand what Shankara was saying, what Madhva was saying, what Ramanuja was saying, what the Vedic literatures are saying, what all the, everyone was saying. Because then there's no contradiction. Because you have a main standard, and then you can say, oh, that's this, that's that. You know. So the sambandha abhideya prayojana. That's there. And then you can describe it, just take that one as and chitta chittishwar. You know? Like that. And then, or you can take it as the dasa mool, or you can expand that. Or so then you can just see, oh, they're talking about this, they're talking about that. It's the same. Because you can't get away from these things. Even the karmis can't work outside of a sambandha vidaya prayojana. You know, when they go and they make their presentations and they do their work, or people who are very expert in material energy, they're only working within these three. You know, it means the person who's expert is able to identify really what are the elements of the what they're going to work with. Like that. Then, and they know what the goal is. They're clear on it. And they're clever enough to figure out how to get these elements to that goal. You know? You have the elements and you want them to relate to each other in a particular way. And that relationship is the goal you're trying to get. And they know how to put the elements together so they get that. So the gross materialists are very expert at this. But they haven't identified it as these three. They won't have identified it like this. So therefore the conclusion of how this material world works is this. Sambandha vidaya prayojana. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I'll say you said another thing in relation to this, that in general Bhagavad Gita, the essence, like the emphasis is sambandha. In Bhagavatam, in the books that expand from that, there's Abhidaya and then Sistik Prajna. Does the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam also Prajna? And Sistik is an expansion of that?
Yeah, no, it's that all three have all three in it, but it's just that there's so much more. Like you see, See, in in Gita, it's making us aware of the spiritual platform. So it's trying to establish who is the soul, who is God, what is the material world. That's the main emphasis. But you see in there, the whole process of devotional service is discussed. And the goal of attaining to the Lord is discussed. But it's not expanded in great detail. Well, in the Bhagavatam, then you see how all different kinds of devotees are able to, how they took shelter of the Lord, how they were successful in achieving that. You know, Aditi, she had material desire. Though that material desire is in line with the Lord's desire. But it's still, she's interested that the universe should run properly as the Lord wants it, that the demigods should be running the place and not the demons. Mainly because the demigods were her sons. You know, it wasn't that she was as much worried about universal management as she was about her sons. But being the pious lady she was, she would see it in relationship to the Lord. Right? And she would see the, and she was pious that she would see the process, you know, of nature and that. So therefore, then she approached her husband to give direction, you know, as guru. And she wanted to do the proper religious thing. So then he gave direction to worship Vishnu by that Payavrata. Then she performed that. From that, then she saw the Lord, got the Lord as her son. So in this way, then, you know, what you see her progress in the whole process. You see Dhruva Maharaja's progress from wanting a big kingdom to actually becoming a devotee. You know, Prachina Barhishat, you see him from being a Karmakandi, then becoming a devotee. You know, like this. You know, the Pachetas from being yogis to becoming devotees. Like this. And so many of them, you see how they progressed on their path and then at one point then surrendered to the Lord. So you see that. Then you see of that, then the best is the residence of Vrindavan. Like that. And then of that, then the best of the gopis. But that's still not so clear there. It's still hidden to some degree. So then Chaitanya, so it goes through and explains Prayojana. The whole point is to get to Prayojana, just like the whole point of the Gita is to get to Prayojana and explain the process. But then Chaitanya Charitamrita, then it takes it to an even deeper, finer level. So to go to that final level, it must explain the process and the elements that you're dealing with. But now it's on a more finer level. Like that. So does that make sense?
Yes.
Like that. That's just very general. Though it's basically speaking, there's only Bhagavatam. And so Gita and Chaitanya Charitamrita are expansions of that. You know, so that the Gita is teaching us how to get to that platform, and the Chaitanya Charitamrita is how to actually attain perfection within it. What is our path for attaining perfection? Based on the teachings that the Bhagavatam is giving us, how to become perfect. Like that. Because Abhideya is the central teacher. And that's the thing that's the result. The result is Abhideya, is that service. One is attracted to Krishna, one develops one's attachment to Krishna, and then that gives way to serving Krishna. Right? So that service is the main thing. That's why it says the soul is love, but what does that love mean? You do something to show that love. So that means service. So that's why you get these. You can say is the sarup of the soul is service. Same time as you can say he is love. The nature of the soul is love. Because love means you've been attracted as somebody or a son or sat. You know, he has that natural affection. That's prayojana. or that's flooding. And then the result is one will do activity. That's the sundays, and that is the avideya. There's just Krishna sitting there and loving, and the living entity loving, and there's no idea of exchange. That's not what Krishna is looking for. Or just to be attracted and not do anything. You know, that's like santaras is like that. You appreciate, but you don't do any service. You just appreciate. The appreciation is service. Right? What we see is that it's the service and that interaction that makes it relishable. So the avideya makes the attraction and the attachment relishable. Yeah, it should be under authority. So that means under authority means it's properly following in the line of the authority. Because that's the service in Vrindavan means following in the footsteps. It means anywhere in the spiritual realm means following in the footsteps of the previous acharyas. So then in that way then the service is naturally then given. But service is inherent in the living entity, as is love for Krishna is inherent in the living entity. And by nature we have a certain kind of service that is basically in tune with our nature. Like that. You know, though Krishna will arrange situations to fulfill any kind of desire of service by the devotee, even if it's not been done before, he'll create it. You know? But better to follow in the footsteps of those who know the best way to, you know, Krishna can create a new way if you want to serve him. But if he has to create a new way, it means it's not the best. You understand? Because Radharani is already doing the best. The residents of Vrindavan are already doing the best. So we can either follow them or, you know, have them create something new. Does that make sense? Yeah, so it's both are happening. It's natural, but at the same time it's given to us. Because even you say it's natural, but it still must be in line with what the others know will please Krishna. Therefore, since we don't know, they know Krishna, therefore better we learn from them how to serve Krishna. Does that make sense?
He says that these mantra, fully engage our mind, words and activities completely in the mind.
It's interesting, if we look at body, mind, and words, in devotional service. So you take that statement, to engage our body, mind, and words in the Lord's service, that right there cuts all the four egos.
Mm-hmm. Right?
I mean, because the body, right, means, I don't remember the names of them. I think I'm not sure if that's tamasa or, yeah, that's tamasa or something like that. It means the identification with the body. So that's the false ego that goes with that. Then I think tejas or something is the intelligence and senses. Right? So of all the senses, the most important is in here that you can see something from is the speech. That's what you can really tell what's going on, right? You can't tell what the person's smelling or hearing or tasting or touching, but you can tell when they speak. So of all the senses, then that's the one that actually identifies. And the senses are connected to the intelligence, right? You can't speak nicely without the intelligence being functioning. So that takes care of that ego. And then mind is mind. So our desires. And then in the service of the Lord means that it purifies that consciousness. So then we give up the idea that I'm the enjoying controller, and we take shelter of Krishna. So we see this, that itself cuts the whole material existence. We've heard it again and again and again, but this is what it means. You know, it means that it's complete. There's, outside of this, there is nothing. And that's why they say these things. The body you can see, not mind, intelligence. You're thinking of Krishna, you're speaking about Krishna, and then the body will do. And you can only think if then it's because you want to please Krishna. Like that. Otherwise, then Kamsa was also thinking about Krishna, talking about Krishna, and physically, you know, trying to get rid of Krishna. So he was also body-minded, words absorbed in Krishna, but it wasn't favorable. That's why it says favorable, because otherwise then that fourth ego is not corrected. You know? You may have done three, you know, he's in rasa with Krishna, fear and horror, like this kind of thing. But the last one hasn't been taken care of, so therefore it's not called devotional service. So it says devotional service is activities done that are favorable. Otherwise, these are also done in relationship to Krishna, but they're unfavorable, so it's not devotional service. So that distinguishes it, is that the fourth ego hasn't been cut.
And the 64 angas expansions of the 95 or the 9.
I'd say it's the main five, because the five then expand into the nine, and the five would expand into the nine. Because you see, Padasevanam, Archanam, and Bandhanam are all like connected, and like that. Like that, but Archanam is you know, it's one of the things you offer prayers to the deities, or means within deity worship. Then you also, you know, serve the Vaishnavas. The chant means in deity worship the other four also are there. It doesn't function without the other four. Like that, it doesn't work. If you just worship the deity but don't perform the other four, the deity isn't actually very satisfying.
What did you say? That intelligence in the words, and how words cut.
Intelligence and senses,
yeah, that's
go right. Together.
Yeah, that's true.
So, if someone's just sitting there and thinking, how do you tell what's going on? Right? So, if any of the working senses are going on, if somebody's walking, how do you know what's going on? If it's devotional or not? Right? You understand? The arms are moving, the legs are moving. How do you tell? So you take the intelligence and all the senses, knowledge gathering and working, how do you tell if the person is Krishna conscious? Which one of them will show? That you can see, you can actually gauge.
Words.
So therefore when you say words, you take care of that whole thing. The 10 senses and then intelligence are all taken care of by that. You know? If we say the body, then that takes care of all the identifications, the ego, you know, I'm human, I'm from this place, I'm from this state, I'm from this community, I'm from this strata in the community, I'm from this particular family in this community, in the family I'm this, and like this. So it gets rid of all that.
It's interesting also about the view of the story of goodness, but it also includes the body, mind, and speech.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that's that. It's austerity then means, yeah, body, mind, and words. So then it's complete.
Yeah.
Like that. And then that's connected for the Supreme. Because that's pious, but if it's done for the Supreme Lord, then it becomes devotional. So it gets rid of the four. So that was Arjuna's thing, is he's going out there to be the big Kshatriya. But he didn't understand that he's not the enjoyer and the controller. It's the Lord. So he wasn't seeing the relationship with the Lord. So he was just talking on the pious platform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's starting from high level of Dharma. Like that. Mm-hmm. So then So, but Krishna is saying that you're speaking dharma, but you're not actually understanding what dharma is. Because dharma, you're not understanding the soul. So, if you can't understand the soul, you really can't understand dharma. Like that. Because it's then that you're seeing it in control and enjoying it. You're not seeing it from serving. Like that. Or you'll get a mix of the two. But for the devotee, they can understand that we're servants. So of Krishna. And everything's coming from Krishna, and Krishna set it up in this way. So therefore we take part in that, according to Krishna's direction, not according to our own. We should stop here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.